In 15th century Spain, the Spanish Inquisition reveals the ritual murder of a child. Or does it?
4 feet distance from the bed, there was a heap of ashes, 2 legs untouched from the foot to the knee, with their stockings on. Between them was the lady's head.
I'm Fraser Coffeen.
I'm Jennifer Coffeen.
And this is Creepy History. Welcome to Creepy History.
Hello, everybody.
We are very excited for this one. This is episode 7. That's a lot of episodes.
Isn't it episode 8?
Well, it depends if you count the mini or not. It's episode. It's a real proper episode 7.
Yeah, episode 7 plus a mini.
Exactly. That's very exciting. It feels like we've come very far.
I think so.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, I've lost all track of time.
Well, it's pandemic time. It's all one big batch of time.
Lump of time.
Yes. That's how it goes.
Yeah.
But that's all right.
I'm really excited for stories tonight.
It'll be great. Do you want to hear about the cocktail that we're drinking to go with our stories tonight?
Please do. I have a real Moody's Pub vibe from Chicago, if anybody knows that pub out there.
Yep.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is not one that I was able to really keep a secret from you, because this is a drink that you have had many times in your life.
Sure.
As have I. We are, of course, drinking sangria.
Yay!
Very exciting. As you heard in my beginning there, my story takes place in Spain during the Spanish Inquisition, and so I went with a traditional Spanish drink, and I decided to go for the sangria.
Yeah.
I was a little nervous about it because, you know, it's dealing with wine, and I'm not like a wine guy, so I don't really know like which wines to use and things like that. I had to do a little research there.
Can I ask you, like, what do you mix with the wine?
So for the sangria here, it is a, you can get some different kinds of wine. I went with a Pinot Noir.
Okay.
And then it's a little bit of brandy, some simple syrup, and some fruit.
All right.
So we've got orange and orange juice, and we've got lemon, and I did Granny Smith apples because it seemed like the right season, some sort of seasonal fresh fruit.
Oh, nice.
It's interesting how many, I looked for Spanish cocktails, it's interesting how many of them are wine-based. The Spanish cocktails are all about, like, taking wine and putting stuff in it.
Yeah, so we went to Spain, and I know we drank sangria there. What else did we drink there? We were probably drinking beer.
I mean, beer and sangria. I don't really recall drinking a whole lot else.
Do you remember we went some event, and like they outside of our hotel or hostel or wherever we were staying, they had like a vending machine for beer.
Yes.
Which I've never seen before.
Yeah, and then you could spend like €50 and get a beer.
Like like a can of beer. Like you would get like a can of Coke or something.
Yeah.
I was like, yes. It was amazing.
It was good stuff. So yeah.
Those are my Spanish memories.
That's it. just getting the beer.
I'm like, you guys, they have vending machines for beer.
It's the greatest place. You can just get beer right from a vending machine.
And then we had that. My other sangria memory is when we went to Puerto Rico and we went out to dinner and we ordered sangria. And it was a huge pitcher.
Yeah.
Like, really big. And, of course, we're drinking and we're having the best time ever. And then we decide, probably, like, you know, 3/4 of the way through it, that we're going to get another one.
Yeah, bad choice.
And then, of course, we barely can drink the second one. Then we get the bill, and it's like, I mean, it was really a lot of money.
They were $35 per pitcher, so we had spent $70
on sangria. And this is back in the day. I mean, honestly, I wouldn't be excited about spending $70 on sangria now. But we did not have the money to spend on that.
It was a poor decision.
We had a very strict budget, so we're like, well, I guess tomorrow we're eating peanut butter.
But as you said in introducing the sangria, I think it's very important to note that, yes, we've had sangria in those places, but by far and away, the most sangria I've consumed in my life has been at Moody's Pub on the north side of Chicago. Shout out to Moody's, best burger in Chicago.
I spent most of my 20s drinking sangria at Moody's.
And I love Moody's. I'm going to go on a limb and assume that sangria at Moody's was probably not the most authentic Spanish recipe in the world. I'm just guessing.
Oh, poor Moody's. No, maybe they really did it up.
It was a lot of sugar.
It was so much sugar.
Tremendous amount of sugar.
It
bordered on being Hawaiian punch.
Hawaiian punch sangria.
You know what I mean?
Maybe they made it. Instead of red wine, it was Hawaiian punch.
It's right on the edge.
It was just Hawaiian punch, brandy, and
cherries, a lot of cherries.
There was a point in my Moody's going years, which I mean, I lived down the street from Moody's for a long time. I went to Moody's all the time, where I had to say, do you remember it? I was like, I have to stop drinking the sangria. I can no longer drink the sangria.
Of course I remember it. It was heartbreaking. It was terrible.
It was making me sick.
I know, but I can't drink a whole pitcher by myself.
I know.
Rough.
And then we would like, because it's always like a big group of people at the table, and it was like, who's getting the sangria? Who's getting the beer? Yeah. And then sometimes I'd be the lone beer person at that point, and everyone's like, ugh, Jen.
Sorry.
I know. I tried. But this one seems like it's more authentic.
I made it during the day, and it's been sitting in the fridge kind of, you know.
Really?
Because
where was it? I didn't see it.
It was hiding.
Oh.
Because that way it's sort of, you know, the flavors get to kind of, you know, marinate together.
All right. I'm excited.
Cheers.
Cheers. Are we going? Okay. It's not my fault. We had to take a brief pause because we got interrupted.
It's all good. We're back.
We're back now. This is very good. It's not. Actually, it's really made me understand how sugary Moody's sangria was. Cafe Oberco. Would drink, but I think theirs was kind of sweet as well.
It's good.
This is really lovely.
It's interesting how much it's changed. So I had a sip when I first made it, which was probably like. It was probably like 7 hours ago at this point. And probably not quite that, 4 hours ago. And it was, it really, I was like, oh, I don't know about this. It just tasted like wine.
Right.
But now it really has like the flavors have kind of come together.
Yeah, it's really, it's very nice. It's very refreshing. It's very crisp.
Refreshing for a summery day in the middle of November where there's, you know, hail in the morning.
Yep.
It's all right.
All right.
All right. Well,
go. I think this one, I liked last week's too. The French 75. I like this one. We're on a good track now.
Good.
Yeah. For the drinks.
Now that we've gotten rid of the Manhattan.
Yeah. That was a lot. I did get a text from a friend of mine saying that she drinks Manhattans all the time. And I was awesome. Like, really? Oof. Yeah. I could hardly do it. I could only kind of smell it.
It's a fine drink.
Yeah. It's all just right. A lot. All right. I'm ready for creepy stories.
Now that we are.
It feels like a creepy story kind of night.
Good. Now that we're drinking our Spanish sangria.
Yep.
One more sip.
All right.
Good. Now that we're drinking our Spanish sangria, I am ready for my story.
Yeah.
Let's do this. So, the title of my story is The Holy Child of LaGuardia.
I do not know anything about this.
Excellent.
I'm really pumped.
I'm excited about it. Yeah. So part of the reason that I chose this one is simply because I don't really know a tremendous amount about the Spanish Inquisition, and so I kind of wanted to look into it a little bit more.
I don't either, I guess. Yeah.
So it's interesting. So I'll tell about the Holy Child of LaGuardia, and that's what I'll talk about, but I do need to kind of start with a little bit of a background knowledge about the Spanish Inquisition. My sources for this, there's a couple I'll mention during the course of it, but in addition to that, there's Wikipedia, Encyclopedia Britannica, online. I don't have an actual encyclopedia. Sorry, the online version.
You like pull the box out.
I think it's just called Britannica nowadays.
We had an Encyclopedia Britannica, I think, but did they have different versions of it?
Yeah, they had to redo it all the time because, like, you'd put a version out and then, like, you know,
I feel like we had
the Titanic would sink and they'd be like, uh-oh, we better put something in the new tees.
That's amazing. I had, like, a kid's version, but I'm wondering if it was a different thing. Anyway, whatever.
So, yes, that. And then the Jewish Virtual Library. So
nice.
So, Holy Child of LaGuardia, Spanish Inquisition. So, a little background there. The Spanish Inquisition began in the late 1400s, the 15th century, obviously, in Spain. And at that time, there was a very strong desire to unite everyone in the country under Christianity, right?
That's going to go well.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. I tend to think in my head as the Moors being kind of the main target of the Spanish Inquisition, but it's not actually true. They had been... there had previously been more conflict between the Christians and the Moors, but they weren't kind of the main focus here.
Okay.
The main focus of the Spanish Inquisition is, in fact, the Jews, the Jewish population of Spain. And in particular, there is a group of Jews that they are looking towards here in the Spanish Inquisition. And that is a group called the Conversos. The Converso, you might hear the word, you know, convert in there. It is the name for those who were in Spain at the time and who were Jewish and who converted to Christianity.
Okay.
Converted to Christianity, largely because... there's an Inquisition on the horizon and they can sense it. And they're
like it was becoming dangerous. And I'm sure if that was happening, like, I'm sure they weren't being treated great.
Correct.
So, you know, it was probably if you wanted to, you know, rise up in certain, you know, in your, like, in certain jobs or, you know, this and that, like, it was probably for some better to do that.
Well, in theory, yes. But the interesting thing is, right, then these conversos are the target of the Inquisition because they're not Christian enough. They're not really Christian. They've only converted. The sense is that they've only converted in order to, escape the stigma of being Jewish, not because they truly feel the love of Christ in their heart.
So what are you supposed to do then?
Just, you know, not be Jewish in the first place.
Jeez.
Yeah. There's not anything really good here. Some of these conversos
They're not interested in converting people.
No.
They're just interested in, like,
and just like
one race, you know, yes. I mean, one religion is going to be the religion.
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
And that's it. Absolutely. You're it or you're not.
Yeah, because it is the converts who they're looking towards here. Some of these conversos still did indeed practice Judaism secretly.
Sure.
But some did not. And there were various degrees to which they were they had given up their faith in, you know, sort of in earnest or not.
Right.
You're eyeing your sangria. You were nervous about it.
No, I might have swallowed a orange seed.
I mean, there's definitely seeds in there.
So
you know, be warned.
If I start choking, you'll know why.
There's seeds. Fine. There's ice. There's peels. There's all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, it's fine.
All right. Good. So this is the context, right? And again, I didn't know that. I think a lot of the Spanish Inquisition, oddly enough, is sort of, at times, it's almost kind of like a punchline, right? I think it's because of Mel Brooks' History of the World Part 1.
Sure.
And the No One Expects the Spanish Inquisition
bit. Yeah.
And then, like, Gary Larson had a lot of far sides about the Spanish Inquisition. So, like, my context for it is, like, very much just like, it's Spanish Inquisition, haha.
Yeah.
Which is not good.
His probably weren't, like, historically correct. I think it was just like, you know, it was just sort of like, I don't think
any of those three things that I just cited are historically accurate.
I know I've read it, like, in certain fiction, like, it'll be referenced or there'll be, like, you know, I know I've read it in, like, historical fiction where there's, like, things taking place there or stuff like that. But, yeah, that's kind of all I know as
well. Right, right. So the time that it really kicks off, that's kind of the background for it. That's sort of the atmosphere that was setting it up. And I will say, let me just be totally clear about this. I am giving a way oversimplified version here, right? You know, it's history. It's a huge complex thing. There's lots of different factors in here. This is this very broad strokes view of it, right? So in 1478 is when things really get going because the Pope at the time, Pope Sixtus the Fourth, that's right, Sixtus the Fourth.
Sixtus the Fourth.
Very confusing. He issues a papal bull allowing Spain to name inquisitors to look into this problem. And those inquisitors...
It's not going to go well.
Nope, it's not going to go well. Those inquisitors are... Spain is allowed to name them themselves, so they're not reporting directly to the Pope. And they are... They're tasked with, you know, going forth and finding these conversos and finding the heretics and, you know, making sure that Christianity is what's reigning supreme and that any Christian is truly practicing the Christian faith and is not, you know, secretly practicing, you know, tenets of Judaism behind closed doors.
Yeah.
That's their job.
And so what are they going to do when they find people who aren't doing that?
Burn them.
Yeah. Oh, jeez.
Yeah. No ifs, ands, or buts about that.
Yeah.
That's the plan. So that's 1478. It is instantly out of control.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Immediately, it all goes to pot
right off
the bat. When you give
someone that kind of power to just go out and find these people, of course it's going to go crazy.
Yeah, it's bad. It's bad. So they set up these courts of Inquisition. The first one's in Seville, and...
Hey, we went to Seville.
Yeah. Well, there's great history here for Seville. they get the proud distinction of being the site of the first, you know, court in the Spanish Inquisition. It goes poorly.
Sure.
They're burning people. They're torturing people. It's bad. Sixtus, the Pope, tries to intervene, but nope, he can't.
It's too late.
It's too late. The cat's out of the bag. He can't stop anything.
What did he think was going to happen?
I don't know.
He just didn't think he was going to get that out of it. He thought it was going to be more quiet, maybe.
Maybe.
Quiet murder.
I don't know. Maybe not all the torturing, but anyway, it's out of hand. He tries to stop it. He fails.
Something just dinged in my head. I think that I know some about the Spanish Inquisition in terms of the torture devices that they use. Remember when we went to that torture museum?
So there are lots of torture museums you can go to. Uh-huh. Now, I have heard mixed things about the authenticity of those torture museums. That some of them, it seems that some of the torture devices, when you go to these like torture museums in Europe or wherever, that some of them were accurate, but that others are like made up nonsense. That like they didn't actually torture people this way.
What?
There was one about how like you would lay on the ground and they would put a boat on top of you, and the boat would have just your head and your hands and your feet sticking out from the sides, and then they'd fill it with rocks until like it smushed the rest of your body. I'm like, I don't think that's accurate.
But how do you know? I can totally see them doing that. They used to put people under just giant rocks.
Yeah, but I don't know. Anyway, the point is,
not to brag, but I've been to many torture museums.
I think that the torture museums started in, we're going to have to look this up, but I believe that they started, that they're almost like a Barnum-esque circus thing with some authenticity, but also some fakeness.
Okay.
I think that's the gist.
Okay.
They're sort of P.T. Barnum-ish.
If anybody out there has the, you know, the down low on what are the authentic torture museums versus the non-authentic.
Versus the hokum.
Yeah, I would like to know about it.
All right, we'll look into this.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm making a note. I'm making a note in my notebook that says
torture museum.
Torture? Question mark? That's the note.
That's the best.
Good. Oh, boy. So it's out of control. He decides, all right, well, you know, if you can't beat him, join him. And in 1483, 5 years after he is issued that first papal bull, he names a grand inquisitor, one person who will be in charge of all the inquisitors and all the courts. And that person is a pretty infamous person in history, the sort of name most associated with the Spanish Inquisition. That is Tomás de Torquemada.
Okay.
A lot of people have heard of the name of Torquemada. Torquemada is the first Grand Inquisitor, again, appointed in 1483. He remains the Grand Inquisitor until he dies in 1498. And he is an important figure here. He's a friar prior to becoming the Grand Inquisitor.
Mm-hmm.
And he is most notably a friend and advisor to Queen Isabella. Queen of Spain.
Okay.
Very important. And he met her before she was even queen, back when she was, I believe she was princess. And they...
she worked as a barista.
Yeah. But she was just at the local watering hole.
She's taking acting classes and working her way up.
Working, she's making it. So they were buddies. And he becomes her advisor. And he joins her in the court. It's Torquemada and Isabella and Ferdinand, the king, Isabella's husband.
Right.
It's them who start to really feel that the Conversos are a threat to the monarchy. They're too powerful. Sadly, they perceive that they have too much control over the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, another example of that sort of Jewish stereotype,
absolutely,
right?
Of
the, you know, the economic influence, and that they're just too powerful and they need to be dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
So they're gonna,
and that's probably, unfortunately, really what it was about.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Like, you know, the money wasn't all in one place.
Right.
And so other people were earning money or, you know, making money or whatever.
Or having influence or gaining power or anything.
Right,
like that.
And they wanted to take that away, yeah.
Fun fact about Torquemada, his grandmother was a converso.
What?
Yep. Yep.
How do you justify that in your head? Did he hate her?
Oh, there's not a lot of documentation about his thoughts on his grandmother.
He didn't leave a diary behind?
He did not.
He didn't have, like, a Facebook account?
But his grandmother was a converso, and there were other people in his family who were conversos as well.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So you have to wonder, and of course there's probably no evidence, you know, or whatever of this, but, like, did he protect them in some way or like put them in a different category or, you know what I mean? So that like they weren't for whatever reason, they weren't really that or hiding it. Or did he straight up hate them and persecuted them as well?
Yeah. It's hard to say. I'm sure she's probably dead by this point.
That's true.
Yeah.
But if other family members were,
right.
I mean, you know, or maybe they were all gone or something, but like, I don't understand how you put that in your head.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, jeez.
So yeah. No, just another reason that he is not a good man.
Yeah.
Many, among many. So that's the background. So let's dive into the Holy Child of LaGuardia, the meat of the story. So this starts in 1490. So this is, we are now 12 years into the Inquisition.
I don't mean to interrupt again. This is Columbus time as well, right? It's Ferdinand and Isabel.
Yeah, these are like, the people who send Columbus. Who
send Columbus.
These are those two.
Yeah, so remember, I mean, Columbus is garbage. So, you know, they're the ones who are like, go off, do whatever you want.
Yeah, 1492.
Yeah.
So says the
rhyme. Yeah.
1492, all Columbus right. sailed the ocean blue. Yeah, we're so 1490 is our story, 2 years before Columbus set sail.
We saw Columbus's body or some grave or something, right?
Yeah, somewhere in Spain.
I can't remember where it was either.
So 1490, 12 years into the Inquisition, 7 years into Torquemada's reign as Grand Inquisitor, our setting is the town of LaGuardia in Toledo in Spain. And out there in Spain, there is a converso gentleman, age 60 years old, named Benito Garcia. And he is traveling by foot, obviously, and he is arrested, and he's, again, he's a converso.
Mm-hmm.
He's arrested, and he is accused of secretly practicing Judaism, which
How
is
do
what
you
happened.
Even know? This guy, he has no identification. They're not, they can't look anything up on these people. How do you know this person is?
I don't know.
Somebody just rat him out?
Well, yes. That's the gist of how this all stuff
goes.
Yeah,
I knew that was the whole thing.
Is that basically, it's all like a whole series.
Telling on your neighbors kind of thing.
Exactly. It's a whole series of like, I arrest this guy, and then I torture this guy, and then this guy gives me these five names.
Right.
And then I arrest those five guys.
Which we all know.
And they
from,
torture them.
Like, Salem witch trials and, you know, everything else, and Law and Order and all that. Is like, it does, like, people, when they're being tortured, they're going to tell you anything.
Yes.
They'll tell you anything you want to know.
That is the evidence of the Salem witch trials and Law and Order.
Yeah.
No doubt. So yes, so he's arrested. He's accused of secretly practicing Judaism, and this is how it goes in the Inquisition. This is, you get arrested for this. This is oftentimes the charge. You're jailed, and like I said, you're often tortured and you know, asked to give up other names.
Yeah,
he does have on him at the time. He's carrying with him a consecrated host. So file that away in your memory banks, as it'll come up later.
Okay.
And he's taken to jail. As we talked about, he's tortured, and he names some other conversos who he has associations with. They names a handful of people. One important name is a gentleman named Yusef Franco. Franco is much younger. He's about 20 or so, and is an associate of Garcia's, another converso. So Yusef then is also arrested, and same kind of process goes through here. While Yusef is in jail, he becomes very ill, and he says he thinks he's going to die in prison. And so he asks for a rabbi and says, you know, well, if I'm already, you know, accused of being a Jew, then and I'm going to die.
Might as well go,
you know,
for
let
it.
let me, you know, make peace and, you know, go through the Jewish customs, you know,
right.
as I'm going to die here. So he asks for a rabbi. The jailers lie. And actually send in a friar in disguise who pretends to be a rabbi.
Oh, my God.
And he meets with Yusef. And in the course of that conversation, you know, there's a little bit of conflicting stories here. And this is going to be a very common theme throughout.
Yeah.
Trying to pin down exactly what happened is extraordinarily difficult. But the gist is that this friar slash fake rabbi asks Yusef why he is in jail, and Yusef says he's being charged with the murder of a boy, of a Christian boy. Now, it's important to note that at this time during the Inquisition, they were arrested, but they weren't actually like told what they were being arrested
for,
or like given the charge. So he doesn't actually know. He's just
unloading,
guessing.
Yeah.
Just guessing here. The murder of a Christian boy. And that's what he says.
Suspicious.
Yes. But it's unclear if he even actually said that.
Sure,
because,
of course.
Because he never says it again. Yeah. This is just this friar who's already lying about being a rabbi.
Right.
Says
and
that
already
that's
looking
what he said.
For ways to, you know, torture and
Right. So it's unclear if he even truly said this or why he said this or anything like that. But this idea of being charged with the murder of a Christian child, this is pretty common at the time. So, you know, if he was just taking a shot in the dark at what he was being arrested for, this is not a totally out of left field guess.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of concerns about this during this time period. In fact, and dating back much earlier, going to give you a quote from the super exciting 7-part Code of Castile.
Ooh.
Written in the 13th century by Spanish King Alfonso X.
Okay, I'm ready.
The 7-part Code of Castile. So again, this is 13th century. This is about 200 years earlier. And in that code, he says, "And because we have heard it said that in some places Jews celebrated and still celebrate Good Friday, which commemorates the passion of our Lord Jesus Christ, by way of contempt, stealing children and fastening them to crosses and making images of wax and crucifying them when they cannot obtain children. We order that hereafter, if in any part of our dominions anything like this is done and can be proved, all persons who were present when the act was committed shall be seized, arrested, and brought before the king. And after the king ascertains that they are guilty, he shall cause them to be put to death in a disgraceful manner, no matter how many there may be." So there was a lot of concern at the time that Jewish people
are like stealing our children. Yeah.
Stealing kids, ritually murdering them, putting them on the cross in a sort of blasphemous, you know, act. This was a common thought. It is known as a blood libel, this idea of you know, putting this out there and blaming these murders on the Jews. There is a long history of Jewish people over the centuries being accused of this, being found guilty of it. There is very, very, very little evidence that it like ever happened.
Right, that's what you're saying. Like, are there children who are missing? Are there children who are?
It's
like,
very,
you
know? Typically, it's like there's a murder in a town, and they say it must be these Jewish people here in the town who did this for the blood libel. Or they wouldn't call it a blood libel. The blood libel obviously means that it's a slanderous thing, right? They didn't use that term. That's a modern term for it. But this dates back. I mean, there's evidence of this dating back to the first century.
Wow.
These accusations.
Yeah, it's like conspiracy theories, kind of thing. Yeah, and it's Jewish a similar people, thing where like you hear where it's like, oh, you know, this group of people's going to come in and like rape our women, and they're going to come in and like, you know, like steal from us, and they're going to come, you know, it's basically just a way of justifying racism.
Yes.
You know,
exactly. Yeah. And this idea that they're using Christian blood for rituals. There's in fact discussion that the recipe for matzah contains the blood of Christians in it.
Oh,
that's the original recipe for matzah, which is of course, again, not in any way accurate.
Yeah.
There's a lot, if you want to dig into blood libels, there's a lot of different historical evidence here. England has a couple really big ones called Little St. Hugh and Simon of Trent. Those are both people who were murdered in England, and it got pinned on Jewish people accused in this way. So
I've never heard the term blood libel before.
That meaning, that's this idea that like we're blaming them. You know, it's a libel against them associated with this blood ritual.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of, you know, what he thinks if it's true that he said this to the friar, then that is what he is thinking he is going to be accused of.
Right. I mean, if it's been around since the first century.
Yeah, since the first century.
I feel like, you know, it's a pretty good guess.
Yeah, exactly.
You have no idea why you're in jail.
Right. So, you know, am I going to be accused of this?
Yeah.
Much I'm like being many others have been accused of it over the time. So on December 17th, 1490, they decide, the inquisitors decide, they're in Toledo, decide that they have gained enough information, and they put Yusef Franco and Benito Garcia and a group of some other men on trial. And the two charges against them are trying to bring conversos back to Judaism, revert back to their Judaism, and this idea that they crucified and murdered a Christian boy on Good Friday the year prior. So they're murder and
is there a specific boy that they're talking about, or just some boy?
We'll get to that.
Okay, got you.
Go forward. You know, so yes, so that's it. They go to trial, and the trial is I use trial loosely.
Right.
You know, they
just like a room of like screaming.
They have this inquisition where, you know, it's trial like, you know, there's you know, they are lawyers, and there are, you know, they talk about the facts of it and things like that. But it is a mess. it is full of all kinds of contradictory statements from Franco and from Garcia. Sometimes the two of them agree on what was happened. Sometimes they don't. There's times where, you know, Franco will make a statement and then the inquisitors will request a break, and they will, like, take a break and, you know, take him to the back and, like, torture him, and then come back to the trial, and he'll be like, I was mistaken, let me I need to change what I said before the break.
So do you feel, I mean, it was obviously a foregone conclusion. Like, yes, like, absolutely. Not a trial, because, I mean, did anybody get out of these trials? Like, was absolutely everybody put to death, or did anybody manage to
escape? That I don't know. That's a good
escape,
question.
I don't know. That's the thing.
Probably not many, I would imagine.
So it's not Law and Order.
Right, yes. So, yeah, so it's just, you know, it's all over the place. And trying to get to the heart of what really happened, obviously, is just impossible, right? Well, because it's just all, you know, they've got their narrative, and they're basically just, you know, in advance and during the course of the trial, just sort of using these torture devices to get them to confess what they want them to confess.
Sure.
And obviously, if you torture someone enough, they will confess what you want them to confess.
Of course.
But the story that, you know, kind of emerges there, the tale is that this group of men, Franco, Garcia, and a handful of others, are during Good Friday the year prior. They are in LaGuardia. They meet up in a cave, and one of the men brings a boy there. Again, at some points they say he brought a boy who was already dead. At some points they say he brought a boy who was already alive. At some points they say he brought a boy's heart. You know, it's like it's all over the place, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the idea being that they brought this boy to this cave where they murdered him and took his heart for this
ritual.
Right. And that's kind of, you know, where it is. Takes a little while, but in November 16th, 1491, that's a long time, so I'm assuming that there were other things going on in there.
Right.
But eventually, November 16th, 1491, all of them are found guilty, as to be expected. They insist on their innocence, but it doesn't matter. Their guilt is pronounced at the auto de fe, which is where they the sort of public pronouncement of this. And the penalty, of course, is that all of them are burned at the stake. So they're all executed for this murder. So here is kind of where the story, I think, you know, takes on a different aspect, is kind of, you know, what moves forward is people start digging into it a little bit more. So as time passes, this child who was murdered and who they've been, you know, executed for the murder of, he becomes known as the Holy Child of LaGuardia.
Mm-hmm.
And about 100 years later, these legends start to rise about the Holy Child. They start comparing him to Christ. Apparently there's some aspects of LaGuardia's like geographical layout that are similar to Jerusalem. And there's different things like that. And like, there's like, you know, they start like sort of drawing these parallels, you know, about like, oh, you know, he's a Christ like figure.
Right.
You know, it kind of reminds me a little bit of like when you read about the like Lincoln and Kennedy stuff where people are like trying to be like, oh they're just the same, you know.
Oh no, it's like the same number, there's the same number of letters in Lincoln's name as in Kennedy's name, and they were like born
died
in the same, I don't know.
So they start to find some of those kinds
of
things
of course.
Like, you know, which is a way to justify him being, you know, the Holy Child.
Well,
right?
Justify burning a bunch of men.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So this is all kind of written up. This is about 100 years later. You know, it takes a little while for these legends to sort of, you know, ferment. But in 1583, a friar by the name of Rodrigo de Yepes publishes, I'll try this in Spanish, you ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
La Historia de la Muerte y Glorioso Martirio del Santo Inocente que llaman de la Guardia.
Nice.
The history of the death and glorious martyrdom of the holy innocent, said to be from LaGuardia.
It sounded good.
Thank you.
Don't know if you did it correctly.
I don't know if I did, but I'll go for it.
Quick sidebar. I took Spanish in high school and then some in college. And part of one of my college things is you had to call our professor and like speak and leave him a message in Spanish.
Oh.
And it was like part of your grade. Oh, jeez.
That's challenging.
I don't think I did well.
That's some amazing, like, early tech from that guy.
Right?
Like, call, leave a message on my answering machine.
Yeah.
Well, and I'll evaluate
it. It was an answering machine. It was probably like a voicemail.
Probably.
You know what I mean? But yeah, you had to, it had to be like a whole, I mean, it was long. It was like a paragraph and it was like, how are you? Blah, blah, blah. I'm going to, you know, the biblioteca.
Nice. Oh, man.
The disco.
Sure.
No, that's a library.
The biblioteca is a library, yeah.
Okay, that was embarrassing.
It's okay. Sorry. Not the disco. It's all good.
My Spanish is
don't worry about
not
it.
Great.
It's just fine. It's just fine.
The disco.
The disco, I would assume, is probably called like the discoteca. One would imagine.
I like show up. They're like, we're meeting at the biblioteca. And I'm like, sweet. Show up at the disco. All right. Please continue.
All right. So it's 1583. This friar, he publishes his book. This is not a quote from it, but here's basically the gist of what he says. He says that some converts, after attending an auto de fe in Toledo, planned revenge on the inquisitors by arts of sorcery. So when he says some converts here, he's talking about Garcia and Franco with them. So he's saying those guys, this is the tale. He says, those guys attended an auto de fe in Toledo, and they planned revenge on the inquisitors by arts of sorcery. For the spell, they needed a consecrated host and the heart of an innocent child. Two of the conversos kidnapped the boy in Toledo Cathedral and took him to LaGuardia. There, on Good Friday, they held a mock trial. The boy, who in the legend is sometimes called Juan and at other times Cristobal, is the son of Alonso de Pasamonte and Juana La Guindero. The legend says he has been scourged, crowned with thorns, and crucified at the mock trial in imitation of Jesus Christ. The heart needed for the spell was torn out. At the exact time of the child's death, his mother, who was blind, miraculously regained her sight. After burying the body, the murderers stole a consecrated host. Benito Garcia set out for Zamora, carrying the host and the heart, to seek the help of others to perform his spell, but was stopped in Avila because of the brilliant light that issued from the consecrated host that Garcia had hidden between the pages of a prayer book. After the death of the Holy Child is said to have occurred, several miraculous healings were attributed to him. So that's the legend of the Holy Child.
Yeah.
There's a lot of holes in that story.
You know what's messed up about that story is, like, you know, they're talking about, like, they kidnapped this child, and then they put him in a mock trial, and then they, like, you know, tortured him, killed him, or whatever. And you're like, that's what you did
right.
to those men.
Right. So, yeah. Anyway. But that's the legend that comes up. And as a result of this, the child, the Holy Child, becomes a folk saint and a martyr in Toledo. He is still to this day celebrated in LaGuardia. There's a festival every September, Festival of the Holy Child of LaGuardia. If you were there in September, you can attend it. The consecrated host, remember, Garcia was arrested carrying a consecrated host, and that is can be found today in the monastery of St. Thomas.
They still have the actual host?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so they say.
It lasts that long? Like, they're thin?
I mean, presumably it's, like, in a box sealed, you know. This box contains the holy, the host.
Yeah, it's just some dust.
Just dust. Now, if you were paying attention in the story, you'll note that it says that Garcia went to Zamora in order to find other people and do the spell, and he was carrying two things with him. The host, yes, and the heart. So an obvious question would be like, yeah, so
why wasn't that at the trial?
Because it vanished in a miracle.
Ugh.
Somewhere along the road, miraculously, the heart, as a symbol of the boy's holiness, was ascended to heaven by God.
Why would it be a miracle, though, if it was like the people who killed him?
God took his heart
away.
They're
like helping the murderers by getting rid of the heart. Like, it doesn't make sense.
No, none of this makes sense.
That's true.
So that's what happens to the child this is all unfortunate, but here's a really dire piece of it. In 1492, Isabella, issues the, Alhambran decree, which expels the Jews from Spain. Basically it's a decree giving them 3 months to all Jews in Spain have 3 months to do one of three things, either convert, leave Spain, or be executed.
But if you convert, they're going to come after you anyway.
That is correct.
You know what I mean?
And one of the real horrible ironies of the Spanish Inquisition is that because it is actually something charged by the Pope.
Yeah.
The Spanish Inquisition actually only had jurisdiction over Christians, over like Catholics. So like so by converting, these people actually sort of put themselves in the crosshairs of the Inquisition.
Yeah. Now,
Isabella's law extends that, right?
Right.
This decree says, you know, again, you're converting, you're leaving, or you're going to be executed. This story of the Holy Child of LaGuardia is one of the pieces that she uses to push forth this decree.
Jeez.
And to expel the Jews from Spain.
So how does the Jewish population in Spain feel about the fact that this is like a celebrated holiday, you know?
Like not good, I would imagine. I mean, I don't know for sure, but I can't imagine they feel good about it.
Let's take back on that a little bit. Like, you're basically like, you're holding up this story.
Yeah.
You're saying that this story is true.
Right.
Or is it one of those things like many of ours, you know, holiday, like the whole Columbus thing or whatever, where it's like, it just becomes something different and nobody actually like looks back on what it, you know, the origins of it anymore.
No, not that.
Okay.
No, because, and here's where we wrap things up. There is, you know, as would be expected, you know, from the trial was all based on, you know, their testimony and mm-hmm. that's it, right? Their testimony, their testimony all coming out of torture. The one and only piece of evidence that they had of like any sort of like what we would call, you know, physical evidence is that he had this consecrated host, which is, you know, that's very minor, right? There's no body. There's no heart
yeah.
because it was miraculously ascended to heaven by God. There's nothing.
How do you know it's a consecrated host?
I don't know.
Like, what was it?
I don't know.
It's not like the wafers that I had and like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm sure, like, was it just a piece of bread?
Yeah, I'm not sure. And I don't know if there's like, any,
what does that mean?
I have no idea. And I don't know if there's any justification for why he had it at all. But anyway, so there's
He's
no
like,
evidence.
Dude, they just got a piece of bread
yeah,
in here.
Yeah. So there's no evidence, obviously, that they did this murder. There's no evidence that the murder that they described took place.
Right.
And now here's the real kicker. There is no evidence that there was even any kid. No kid
yeah.
is reported missing from the town. No parent ever comes forth saying, like, my kid is gone. Those parents that they listed in that
yeah,
thing
just, like,
don't
exist.
There is nothing. This kid does not exist.
Yeah, it's just completely made up.
So this was really laid out by a historian, an American historian, many years later named Henry Charles Lee, who in 1889 wrote this. He reviews, goes all through the case and says, "In thus reviewing the evidence, it is difficult to avoid the conclusion that the Santo Niño, the Holy Child,
mm-hmm.
was a mere creature of the imagination, begotten by torture and despair."
Oh, yeah, of course.
Is not, I think in the other cases that I mentioned before, like Little Saint Hugh, for example, there is a kid who is dead.
Right, and they just blame
and
it
they
on
just
this
blame
group of people
it on this
or
group,
something. Yeah.
Right? But
here this is just nothing.
There's just nothing. There is nothing
it's
at all.
It's just absolute, it's like Matt, it's hysteria.
Yeah.
You know?
And yet, despite that, it is still acknowledged as an actual fact.
Wow.
By the Archdiocese of Madrid. If you go to the website of the Archdiocese of Madrid, you can see their description of, I did this myself, you can go and read their description of the Holy Child of LaGuardia. Two quotes from that description. Number one, they say openly in there, they say, "The martyrdom of the boy from LaGuardia had an influence on the expulsion of the Jews in 1492, as I said before with the decree, like
yeah.
they acknowledge that that was part of it.
Instead of
it
followed by an apology?
Nope. It does, however, I found this very, very disturbing. Again, this is on their website today,
yeah.
right now. You can go on there and find it. In describing the, various people who were killed, who were executed here, it describes one of them as, quote, "A Jew who was an expert in spells."
Oh, come on.
So
you're just perpetuating
yeah.
that stereotype.
So for the Archdiocese of Madrid, this is a true story, a true story that's, you know, still relevant today.
It's but I mean, it's just,
yeah.
Here's the thing that's so upsetting is like, in order for them to let go of that story, which at this point they probably don't necessarily believe themselves. You know what I mean? Like there's no evidence, like
right.
whatever. Right. But they have to say we've been perpetuating this myth. We all, like, you always knew it wasn't true. You know what I mean? So you have to say that. And then also you have to accept that the reason why they did it was to persecute this group of people.
Exactly.
Because what other reason is there? And nobody wants to really, truly, truly admit that. Even though it was like, how, it wasn't you.
And
like,
that they were persecuting them under the auspices of the Pope.
Right. And the reason why they really don't want to admit that is because there's probably undercurrents of that going on today.
Sure.
So it's like, you know, then we all have to step back and be like, you know, look at it.
Yep. So that is the Holy Child of LaGuardia, a small slice of the Spanish Inquisition.
That was a and all that went on there. Great story.
Thanks.
I learned so much. Yeah. And I'm very disturbed.
Yeah, it's a disturbing story, but I think it's a really...
It's important.
I think it's an important story to know. And I think it's in it, like I said, I think it's interesting that, you know, that we talk about the Spanish Inquisition somewhat, but we do not talk. I really do not feel that it's out there in the general public knowledge
is the relationship
between that and the persecution of Jews.
I knew that they were like torturing people and like rounding people up and you know that whole thing, but I didn't really know that. And it's a shame that we didn't know that because it's a really important part of history.
Very important.
You know? Yeah.
All right.
Well done.
Thank you.
Okay. While you were doing that amazing story, I have really been drinking sangria.
So your story is going to be awesome.
So I'm going to get my way through my story.
All right.
A little bit of a left turn over here.
Sounds good.
All right. I'll just get started. Here we go. I'll see if you can figure out where I'm going with this. All right. We're going to start in Italy with Cornelia Zangahiri Bandi. I'm probably messing that name up. She was an Italian noblewoman born in 1664 in Italy. She married the Count Francesco Bandi and became the Countess di Bandi of Cesena. And they lived it up and had 7 children. I'm assuming they had a great life.
Living life.
Yeah. Yeah. Doing their thing, right?
Having a good time.
I don't know much
They're
about
in Italy.
What went on. Okay. So now we're in 1731. The Countess is 66 years old, and she had dinner that evening, and she was later described as dull and heavy.
Dull and heavy?
Yeah. Which is a real bummer. Of a like, description.
Just on that particular night or just like in general in life?
Just on that particular night.
All right, well, that's better.
I'm assuming.
I hope.
Hello,
this is my friend the Countess. She's dull and heavy.
It's a
that's brutal.
Really unfortunate description. That might be my worst nightmare.
That's
how I'm known. anyway, okay. So, it's reported that the Countess was a brandy drinker, so she was drinking brandy that evening. She apparently would sprinkle brandy on her body to relieve physical pain, like rubbing brandy, I guess, on your joints or something.
Okay.
And if you have gout or something.
Sure, sure. Probably gout.
As you do.
Feared the gout.
What are you supposed to do back then, right? You're like, well, if I drink this, it numbs me. So I'm just going to rub it on my foot.
Right. When I drink this, I feel better. So certainly it'll help the gout. Yeah.
I don't know if she had gout or not. I'm assuming. Okay. So after dinner and some brandy and dumping brandy on herself, she heads up to her room. The maid accompanies her. The two apparently spend 3 hours chatting and praying. I'm sure that was a fun night. Then the maid leaves her mistress, who's already asleep. The next morning, the maid goes into her room when the Countess is not up at her usual time. She goes to wake her, and she is greeted with a terrible sight.
Oh, is this going to be from the beginning of the podcast?
Are you ready?
Oh,
okay.
Man.
This is the full account described by the Reverend Joseph Bianchini, who is, I don't know, it's somewhere in the 1700s.
Sure.
So, okay, here we go. This is his account.
Oh, this is going to be bad.
4 feet distance from the bed, there was a heap of ashes. 2 legs untouched from the foot to the knee with their stockings on. Between them was the lady's head, whose brains, half of the back part of the skull, and the whole chin were burnt to ashes, amongst which were found 3 fingers blackened.
What?
Yeah, it's rough, right? The maid just walks in on that. All the rest was ashes, which had this particular quality that they left in the hand, when taken up, a greasy and stinking moisture. Oof, I know. The air in the room also observed cumbered with soot floating in it. A small oil lamp on the floor was covered with ashes, but no oil in it. Two candles and candlesticks upon a table stood upright. The cotton was left in both, but the tallow was gone and vanished. Somewhat of moisture was about the feet of the candlesticks. The bed received no damage. The blankets and sheets were only raised on one side, as when a person rises up from it or goes in. The whole furniture, as well as the bed, was spread over with moist and ash-colored soot, which had penetrated into the chest of drawers, even to foul the linens. He goes on. Okay. Yep. Nay, the soot was also gone into a neighboring kitchen and hung on the walls, movable aid utensils of it. All right, here's my favorite part.
Okay.
From the pantry, a piece of bread covered with that soot, this is like the gross, liquidy soot, right?
Yeah.
And brown black was given to several dogs, all of which refused to eat it. And you're like, right? Like, why would they eat it? Why would you give it to them?
Yeah.
Were you giving it to them to see if they would eat it? Or were you just like, here?
Oh, okay.
Disgusting. In the room above it was moreover taken notice that from the lower part of the windows trickled down a greasy, loathsome, yellowish liquor, and thereabout they smelled like a stink without knowing of what, and saw the soot fly around.
That is amazing. This is like...
Thank you, Reverend Joseph.
Wow. Okay, so the impression I have of this is that, so far, is that it's basically like a Sherlock Holmes story,
yeah,
adapted by like the guys who made Saw. Just being like, here we go.
Amazing.
Let's do this.
Why like, hasn't this is horrifying. That happened? That's awesome. Yeah, it's really bad, right? Okay.
Oh.
So basically what they're telling you is the maid walks in, the room is full of soot, and all that's left of our countess is a pile of ashes. It's about 3 feet from the bed, and her lower legs below the knee, three fingers, and the front of her skull, and that's it.
Something about the lower legs I find very disturbing.
Oh, it's so disturbing. Okay. The bed and the rest of the furniture in the room are not affected by the fire, but everything's covered by this greasy, smelly layer.
Oh.
And then, yeah. And on the floor, there's an oil lamp covered with ashes. There's no oil in the lamp. And the sheets, as he said, they seem to, like, the countess had, like, gone to bed and then gotten up at some point during the night.
Okay.
What happened in this room, right? So the cause of death was said to be spontaneous human combustion.
Oh, spontaneous combustion.
That's right. Okay, that's what we're talking about today.
All right.
Okay, so what is spontaneous human combustion, or as they repeatedly called it, SHC, which I found to be very funny.
Sure.
Like, oh yeah, you're working on SHC?
Local SHC expert.
Yeah. Okay. So spontaneous human combustion is the combustion of a living or a very recently deceased human body with no external source of ignition. I'm sorry. So basically what they're saying is you catch on fire for no reason. Like there's nothing that made you catch on fire.
Right.
Your body just does it. The fire is thought to start within the body itself, and this idea of spontaneous human combustion is first proposed by Paul Rowley in 1764 when he wrote an article in the Philosophical Transactions concerning this death of the Countess Cornelia Zengiri Bandy, whose name I probably just
This is the first time that they proposed the idea of spontaneous
combustion. Correct. So this is not the first time that it's happened or that they've seen this type of death before.
But this is the first time that
someone actually, he writes this sort of paper or an article about it, and he refers to it for the first time as spontaneous human combustion.
Okay.
Super quick, I want to give a shout out to my sources, which is Wikipedia, The Independent, and LiveScience.com.
Nice.
Thanks. Okay. Okay, so, so that's really fascinating. I've obviously read a decent amount of about spontaneous human combustion, but I didn't realize this was, like, the first time it was kind of coined.
I appreciate that you said obviously. Okay. I have obviously read a decent amount about spontaneous human combustion.
I mean, why are you doing a podcast like this if you haven't? That's what I'm asking.
Totally valid.
Okay, so are you ready for some more examples
of
spontaneous human combustion?
Yeah, like a tour.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. On July 2nd, 1951, Mary Reeser is a 67-year-old woman who is found burned to death in her house after her landlady realizes that the house's doorknob is unusually warm. I don't know what she's doing, like peeping in or listening to the door. She's like, oh, it's very warm today. Anyway, the landlady notifies the police, and when they enter the home, they find Mary Reeser's, I think I'm saying that right, they find her remains completely burned into ash with only one leg remaining.
Oh, it's the leg again?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just the leg. The chair she's sitting on is also destroyed. During this investigation, the detectives find that Mary Reeser's temperature was around 3,500 degrees Fahrenheit.
Whoa.
This is very puzzling.
I would say so, yes.
As everything else in the room is intact and fine. So the idea is, like, how can her body be at this heat level and nothing else is on fire?
Right.
Like, that doesn't make sense. Mary Reeser she did take sleeping pills. She was also a smoker. One of the theories is that she was smoking a cigarette after she took her pills. Then she fell asleep while holding a burning cigarette, and it could have ignited her gown, which then led to her catching on fire. The investigators also found that the fire had burned a socket, which stopped a clock at 2:26 a.m., suggesting that Mary died around that time.
Okay.
Margaret Hogan is an 89-year-old widow who lives alone in a house in Dublin, Ireland. And she is found burned almost to the point of complete destruction on March 28th, 1970. There are plastic flowers on a table in the middle of the room that are reduced to liquid. A television with a melted screen that's about 12 feet from the chair that she was sitting in, where her ashes were found. And everything else in the room is, like, untouched.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
So her 2 feet, both legs from below the knees, are undamaged.
It's the legs again.
Yeah.
This is a thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll talk about that in a minute. A small coal fire had been burning in the grate when a neighbor left the house the day before, but there's no connection between that fire, and that was like the day before, and and Margaret dying.
Yeah.
And also, like, if there was a coal fire and then that got out of control, more of the room would be burned.
Right, you know? Of course.
It wouldn't just, like, jump over to her on her chair.
Sure.
An inquest is held in April 3rd, 1970, and it records the death to be by burning, with the cause of the fire as unknown.
Yeah, what's so interesting here is, like, they keep being so, like, localized, you know? It's just, like, this exactly. one little spot.
Right, and nothing else is burned.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe a few things around it, but like, it's not catching the room on fire, which right. is what you would expect.
Of course.
In 1641... Danish doctor Thomas Bartholin, he wrote about the Italian knight called Polonius Vorstesis. According to Bartholin, the knight... Okay, so this guy, Thomas, wrote about this knight, Polonius, okay? So according to Bartholin, the knight enjoyed a few glasses of strong wine with his parents at his home in Milan, where he burped fire and... tried to get it out.
Okay.
Okay. He burped fire, succumbed to the flames, and died.
Wow.
And that's it for that story.
We're not getting any further follow-up on
that's
that?
That's all you get for Polonius.
Dang.
So apparently, according to witnesses, which I think were his parents, he's drinking wine.
He burps fire.
He burps fire and catches himself on fire, and that's it for him.
Wow. Okay. That is a short story. That's in and out.
There you go. I was like, wow.
All right.
That's a very intense way to go.
Goodness.
And I was like, are you smoking? And then you burp and you've got, like, brandy, so it just, like, bursts in flames. No, like, what's happening?
And it's burping fire. Oh, man. Okay.
Yeah, it seemed like the fire was already there. I don't know what happened.
Wow.
Anyway. Okay. Moving on. Dr. John Irving Bentley's death is among the cases of spontaneous human combustion, which became very well known by, like, the papers and things like that in the 1960s. The lower leg and a slippered foot of this 92-year-old retired physician are discovered next to the toilet. Sorry.
No, that's these, you just have to laugh at that. By the way, I've decided that I'm going to take a drink of sangria every time you mention a leg or a foot left over. It's so just, drink.
It's so sad. She's poor people.
You did not sell that at all. It's so sad.
No, I just
through
feel
the
like,
through the laughter.
It's just like it just feels, you know, I don't know. I just feel so bad for him. He's just like his foot's like found next to the toilet, surrounded by ashes. Okay, anyway, I'm sorry. Okay, so he's a retired physician, and his lowered leg and his slippered foot are found next to the toilet in his home, and it's surrounded by ash beneath, like, his walking. Sorry.
This is no respect for the dead.
I know. It's just a poor man. Okay.
Poor man and his foot and his toilet.
Yeah, that's what they find. Okay.
Okay.
So what's happening here? Like, what's going on? What is spontaneous human combustion? How does it work, right? Okay. So in the British Medical Journal in 1938, they cite an article by L.A. Perry. There's a lot of citing people. Okay. From this 1823 published book, Medical Jurisprudence. Mm. So it states the sort of common, you know, threads of all these recorded cases of spontaneous human combustion. So they find that they all include the following characteristics. You ready?
Okay.
Have all these things in common. One, the victims are chronic alcoholics. Two, they are usually elderly females. Three, the body has not burned spontaneously, but some lighted substances come into contact with it.
Okay.
The hands and feet usually fall off.
Ah, see, there we go.
Yeah. The fire has caused very little damage to combustible things in contact with the body. And the combustion of the body has left a residue of greasy ashes, very offensive in odor. Yeah. Yikes. Okay, so they basically... So
these are the commonalities. Okay.
They have all these things in common, which is that the stories I just read, they all
Yes,
fit.
They did.
Yeah. So is spontaneous human combustion like a real thing? Can a body actually catch on fire from the inside?
Yes.
And that's sort of what they're saying is like, that's what's happening, right? It's like happening usually in the midsection. Somehow the body is catching fire from the midsection and then kind of having this explosive burning. But then some of the, like, the, you know, the extremities, the hands, the feet, or whatever, are falling off and not, like, then the fire kind of burns itself out really quickly.
Yes, right.
That's why the legs are left behind and that kind of thing.
Because, like, the body burns
and then it's like
through the leg before the leg burns?
Right, like, the leg, like, falls off okay. and hits the floor, and then but the fire goes out so quickly.
Yes.
Anyway. So, obviously, bodies can burn. Like, cremation is, you know, an obvious example of that. But these bodies...
The poor people in my story were all burned.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, like, a body can be reduced to ashes, yes. like, quickly, you know, from, you know, fire. But these bodies are catching on fire with no external flame. They are burning to reduce... They are burning to such a heat that they reduce the body completely to ashes. And not just leaving, because another thought is like, okay, if, you know, like that Mary Reeser, like if she had took some sleeping pills and fell asleep with a cigarette in her mouth, like, and wouldn't it just like burn her arm? Like, you know, that it would catch her entire body on fire yeah. in such a way that it would completely reduce her body to ashes, but not catch the rest of the room on fire? Doesn't seem to make sense.
Like, it would take a while for her body to be reduced to ash.
Oh,
and like during
right.
that time, the whole room would end up in
flames. Right,
slaves.
But it's like this yeah. massive, like quick, fast, but extremely hot,
like
heat.
Super hot heat.
Right, that's then gone.
Huh.
Okay. So many claim that the fire begins in the chest or stomach area, leaving the remains of the legs and hands intact, which we just talked about.
Drink.
Others claim that the furniture and the floors under and surrounding the victims, including some of their clothing, remain mysteriously unburned. So you have to remember, like, that one elderly gentleman, the doctor, his, like, he still had the slipper on his foot.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? That's flammable,
yeah,
you know?
Sure.
Okay, so what can possibly cause people to suddenly burst into flames? Well, about a century ago, it was obviously blamed on God's wrath.
Yeah, natural.
God's just like, psh.
I mean, that's yeah. reasonable, but maybe yeah. we can go a little deeper.
Most victims were assumed to be drunkards who saturated their cells with alcohol. In the 1970s, I like this, a quasi-Freudian explanation came into vogue, suggesting that a person's depressive emotional state could cause them to become inflamed.
Oh, that's so super Freudian.
You're so depressed that you just burst into flames.
Yeah.
Which I'm going to go on a limb and say, if that's true, like, we would all be burning into flames right now.
Yeah, there's going to be, this is... this
like, everybody.
2020 debunks that theory.
You're hanging out on your Zoom meeting and you're just like, okay. So anyway, other people have suggested sunspots, cosmic storms, gas-producing intestinal bacteria, or a buildup of the body's vibrational energy to be to blame. Yeah, I know. So if a person is asleep, they've had a lot of alcohol in their body, they're unconscious or unable to move in some way to put the flames out, like they're elderly, that type of thing, the victim's clothes can act as like a wick. So, people they're like in pajamas or nightgowns or, things like that, which are like flammable clothing. They're in cottons, that type of stuff. Here we go. Sorry. And then the flames will draw on the fat of the body. So there's a flammable oil near the skin surface, which combines with the burning clothing. And this is the theory that this is the fuel to the fire.
Sure.
So you're near something flammable, like, you have a cigarette, or you're near a heater or coal, that type of thing. And then, that kind of sparks it. And then they're sort of saying like the combination of like the heat from your body, the oil, the fat, the oils from your body, and, your clothing, your flammable clothing is causing this like sudden intense fire.
Okay.
There's also a rare medical condition called Stevens-Johnson syndrome that in very extreme cases, it can be mistaken for a case of spontaneous combustion. It's skin disease that is triggered by a toxic reaction to medications like antibiotics, painkillers, and then it gives the appearance of burns and blisters, which can be fatal. But that's not what's going on.
These people are being
reduced to ashes.
Yeah.
One of the thoughts is like, if spontaneous human combustion is a real phenomenon, why isn't it happening more? There's 7 billion people in the world. We don't see people bursting into flames all the time. No one has actually ever been seen bursting into flames.
Right, there's no actual documentation. Yeah.
It's never happened to like animals, or anything like that. So it just seems like, why does it happen to these like random people who are always alone?
Yeah.
And kind of left near a source of, ignition.
I just read something the other day about some case where they documented that a person's body was able to like create alcohol that like within the body itself. Is that like, is that like one of these, is that like a part of this? Like, well, they're creating alcohol within their body and that's like lighting them on fire?
Yeah, they do talk about...
because they're drunks.
Yeah, we kind of talked about that. Whereas like they're saying like if somebody... it seems like all, and again, a lot of the stuff is really old, so there's not like tons of like research on it. But it seems like a lot of these people were heavy drinkers.
Yes.
And have been heavy drinkers for a really long time. So I think one of the theories is if like you have this alcohol kind of like within your body, within your skin. And you've been around, like we've all been around people who've like had a ton to drink. Like you sweat alcohol.
Right.
So if someone's been drinking all day, they're drinking constantly. I mean, are they sweating alcohol? Is it coming out? Does that then make you flammable?
Possibly, because alcohol is very flammable.
Right. And you're wearing like, cotton or something. You're wearing something flammable. You're smoking. You fall asleep.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's the intensity of the heat,
yes,
which is just insane to me.
Huh.
So I mean,
here's what I found, by the way. Yeah. Real quick, I looked it up. Auto brewery syndrome.
Ooh.
Auto brewery syndrome. This is from Healthline.com. In auto brewery syndrome, your body makes or brews alcohol out of the carbohydrates you eat. This happens inside the gut or intestines.
Yeah, so they talk about that. Like that's one of the theories. Is like it's happening. There's something going on like within the bacteria of your body,
intestines,
which is like causing some sort of flammable
thing.
So I mean, there's no real information on this. There's a lot of people who just don't believe it's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
They feel like obviously they just, you know, people fall asleep with cigarettes and things catch on fire. It just, you know, it was like more of a localized fire and that's what it is.
But I can't get past the like high heat aspect of it.
I know. The extreme high heat doesn't make any sense to reduce a body to ashes where there's like nothing left but a leg. And I'll show you
in
a picture.
In a short enough time
yeah.
for it to not damage the room.
Right.
I just don't get that.
Right. There's pictures. I mean, from like the 60s and stuff, I'll show them to you. They're, I mean, it's like ashes and like two legs. It's,
oh, man.
It's messed up.
Okay.
So, I, like, they've documented that this whatever's happening has happened to people. It's not like just like, oh, this happened in like the 1400s or whatever. It's like, right. No, I mean, this is happening. And then I think the latest case was in somewhere in the 2000s, like 2010 or something.
Oh, I was going to ask if there were anything more recent.
Yes. Okay. There was a man in, oh my gosh, I think it was Ireland. I need to look it up. I should have written it down. But in Ireland, like it was an older gentleman and, you know, it was the same thing. They found like a couple limbs and then ashes and they did... like the cause of death was spontaneous human combustion.
That was like what they actually listed.
Uh-huh.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah.
So, there are people who believe in it and are just like, this is a thing, like a medical thing. And then there are people who are like, this is just like, you know, X-Files type of science kind of thing.
It certainly sounds very X-Files for sure. Well, there is an X-Files about this, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah, so, my last sort of thing here is, so this idea of spontaneous human combustion is obviously very popular in literature and media, of course. The death of Mr. Crook in Bleak House, your friend Charles Dickens.
My buddy Charles, yeah.
He just bursts into flame. He's a drunkard. He bursts into flame, you know, like walking down the street.
Well, I haven't read it yet, so spoiler.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Now when I first meet Mr. Crook, I'm going to be like, buddy, you are going to burst into flames. Like,
hopefully it happens early on. Mark Twain, Herman Melville, Washington Irving, many other writers use this in their stories. Spontaneous human combustion has appeared in many movies and television shows, including The X-Files. And yeah, Fantastic Four comic books, all kinds of things.
Human Torch. Sure.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, fire started. No, she was able to start fire. She didn't like burst into flames.
No, but I mean, it's a similar kind of thing, right?
Yeah. So yes, I can't remember what episode in the X-Files, but I'm going to find it. Cause I'm currently going through rewatching the X-Files.
Isn't it that right early now one where Mulder is like all scared of fire? And he has to like, he's like, he, there's like, it ends with him like crawling through the hallway on his
yeah.
stomach because there's like a fire.
Why is he afraid of fire?
I don't know, like but a, he is. Like I remember.
A, yeah.
It's a thing. He has like a phobia.
It's like his Indiana Jones snake thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
I think so.
That seems fair. Yes. So it's just really fascinating because there's really just, you just don't know.
So it's so interesting because like, it's not... Like, there's no hard and fast evidence for it, but there's also all these cases that cannot be explained right. in any other way.
And they're documented cases. There's photos of them. There's, you know, I mean, there's, like, they've had investigators. They've had medical examiners. Well, like, that, you know, they're not, like, cases of, like, again, where you're just like, maybe this is some random story where they're, you know.
That's part of the thing that I find fascinating here is that, like, some of these are more, I mean, like you said, there was that one pretty recently, but some of the other ones you listed are pretty recent, like, you know.
Yeah, 60s, 70s, yeah.
I have a much easier time writing things off when it's like, you know, this is from like the 1700s, because, you know, who knows how accurate the information is from that time, you know
sure.
what I mean? But like, this is, when it's more recent like that, it becomes harder to just dismiss.
Yeah, I'm trying to see if I have a picture here in my book. This book's got some problems.
You guys, the book... The alleged book that Jen is looking at right now is actually just like a collection of pages loosely held within a cover.
Listen,
that once upon a time formed a book, but is now just like,
I know,
a stack of
really
loose leaf pages.
It's really fallen apart.
We're gonna take a picture of these pages yeah. in here and
so
send this.
So this is my Mysteries of the Unexplained book. Oh, it's from Reader's Digest. I bought this book. Oh my gosh, I must have.
It's
been.
Got a sticker on it. You
yes.
bought it from McKay's Used Books for
$8.
$8.
Shout out to McKay's Used Books.
Wherever that may be.
It's in Chattanooga.
Chattanooga, I assume, yeah.
I really hope it's still there. I got to look it up. I went there all the time and got weird books like this. And this is probably my introduction to my creepy history obsession. Well, no, that was earlier. Phone call from a ghost. Sure.
Yeah, this is no phone call from a ghost. But
I reread this entire book every year, and it's not great, but it's so fun. They have a whole like section in here about coincidences. Like, just coincidences. Like, seems weird coincidences.
Okay.
And I just love it so much. And some of them you're like, eh.
They're stretching here. That's okay.
But, oh, it's just the best. And, yeah, it's really fallen apart. I've had this book for a really long time.
Very impressive.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yep. Anyway, so that's Spontaneous Human Combustion.
And fascinating.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, I was like, this has not been my favorite week. I haven't had a great week. But, like, I did not burst into flames from the inside of my body. So I'm going to call it a win.
It's a win. You did not. Man.
What a terrible way to die.
Especially on the toilet.
Oh, that poor man. It's awful.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's Spontaneous Human Combustion.
Wow.
Maybe slow down on the drinking if you drink a lot. So that it does, or don't. I don't think people smoke like that anymore. But
we're literally drinking a cocktail as you say that.
Okay. We have like two a week. Don't fall asleep with cigarettes in your mouth.
For sure. That's you a know. No. That's a no.
Yeah. If you're sweating alcohol...
Yeah,
certainly stay away from anything flammable.
That's bad.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
Cheers.
Cheers.
To Spontaneous Human Combustion.
Yeah.
Let's hope that this isn't the sip that puts us over the edge.
This was really fun. Thank you guys so much for listening in. We will be back next week with more creepy stories.
We're not 100% sure what our schedule is next week.
Oh,
next week is next week will be next. So we come out every Thursday. Next week is Thanksgiving on Thursday.
Yeah.
So we're not 100% sure what next week's schedule will be just yet. We'll get back to you.
Something. Pandemic. It's a pandemic Thanksgiving.
So yeah. Pandemic Thanksgiving. Who knows what it will entail? But we've got that. We have one more regular episode this season, and then we'll be doing a little holiday special, and then we'll be taking a little bit of a break to get ready for our second season.
That's right. Which will be coming very soon.
Soon. I don't know. Like January, February, something like that.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're on a roll.
Yeah.
All right.
Yay. Thanks. All right. Have a great week.
Take care. Hi, this is Fraser. No creepy cocktail for next week, but be sure to follow us on social media as always. Our Instagram is creepyhistpod, our Twitter is creepyhist, and our music is done by myself and Charlie Coffeen. Make sure you follow him on Instagram at Charlie's Keys. Thanks, we'll see you next time.